Hi. Did you know that you can watch Last Podcast on the Left and Side Stories on our Patreon right now?
Yes, that's patreon.com/lastpodcastontheleft. But over on TikTok, you can see the hottest, tightest, funniest clips from the show right there.
It's TikTok.
TikTok. It's at LP on the Left. It's the same as our Instagram. You already follow the Instagram. Why don't you go follow TikTok?
But it's on TikTok.
Yeah, because seeing is believing.
Yep.
So just go check it out. Watch it.
Go send our podcast to China.
I love TikTok the crocodile. It's my favorite TikTok.
It's the only one he knows.
There's no place to escape to.
This is the last podcast
on the left.
That's when the cannibalism started.
What was that?
All right, welcome. We are here. It's me and Ed.
Hello.
Ed Larson. I'm Marcus Parks. Welcome to Last Podcast on the Left. We are here sitting with James Tinian IV.
Hey, guys.
One of the most absolutely incredibly talented comic book writers out there, putting out work right now, and by far the best horror writer out there in comic books right now. Thank you so much for joining us today, James.
Thank you very much, and thanks for saying very nice things about me.
Of course. Thank you for coming back.
The fourth. Yeah. That's very impressive.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
My father changed his last name. He didn't even, I'm the first of nothing.
I was just at a family wedding, and I keep getting, it's one of those things. Everyone's very proud of me and all that shit, but then I get these little, all of a sudden my cousin comes up to me and it's just like, no, they can't Google me. Nobody can Google me. Like my last name, just like everything points to your stuff. And I'm like, I'm sorry. Like, yeah. I don't know. It's there are a lot of Tynans out there, but it's a made up spelling of the last name. It's like a totally made up spelling. So everyone who's those spelling that I have is related to me. So you can bug all those people, nice. Yeah.
No, for the longest time, I was beaten in Google by a Marcus Parks from Baltimore who had no arms but could shoot guns with his feet.
I mean, he should still be number one.
That feels like it deserves the top spot. Yeah.
I actually felt bad when I toppled him. Yeah. I'm like, and that guy really deserves it.
We should have James write a book about this guy. Give him up.
There you go. Yeah. We're gonna, Marcus, you're going down. We're getting this guy back to his.
I'll gladly give it up. Yeah. So Ed here, he is new to comic books.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I had him when I was a kid, but I took a lot of time off. I mean, the last graphic novel I read was like 30 Days a Night, so it's been a while, and the whole time I'm reading Department of Truth, Marcus made me borrow his copy of it. I'm not destroying it, I hope. And
it's fine. Be as rough as you want. Comics are meant to be read.
Fuck yeah. I love that, because I kind of think I broke the spine. I stopped down yesterday just to take a break and absorb everything I just read, because it's like top to bottom information. The pictures are information. Everything's beautiful. And I was just like, I need to change the way I live my life and start getting into graphic novels more. You've changed me completely as a human.
Well, I apologize for that. It's a weird little rabbit hole to fall down. But I guess the whole podcast is kind of about literally every kind of weird rabbit hole that you could fall down.
Ed's entire life has changed in the last few months. He's fucked.
Yeah, man. It's fine. Yeah, I still don't believe in anything, but it's nice to, learn about everyone's fears.
Yeah. No, and it's just like, and this is the thing where it's just like those beliefs start being like, well, it's not, I don't believe it, but I have a lot of thoughts about it constantly, and it just lives in my head. And that starts to leave an effect.
Well, since we are talking about my new knowledge and just reading this, the Department of Truth, I know you guys talked about it a lot in your last interview, but I couldn't help it. I really want to ask this, which conspiracy theory, cryptid, which one do you believe in the most? Like, which one of these in Department of Truth holds the most water to you?
Oh, boy. That's always so hard, because it's just like the like one of the big things that I wanted to hit at with Department of Truth is kind of that I find the most interesting is I kind of see a lot of conspiracy theories like folklore. Like it is just it's the stories that we keep going back to and telling over and over and over through time. And I find it so fascinating that you see the same ones come back, like, you know, like cycles in the way that you can see, you know, QAnon to satanic panic, like going all the way back to, you know, the medieval times. Like it's just like every century, it just pops back up. Sometimes every few decades, it pops back up. And it's just like, I love that. I love it's like, I don't love the effects of that, it's fascinating that when people are put under the same kind of pressures that they come to the same beliefs over and over and over again. It says something about how we think and how we interact with the world. And that's the real, like I say in the first issue, you know, the character Cole Turner, he kind of talks about how how people go towards like conspiracy theories because it helps give structure to the world. And it's just like the awful truth of the world is there's not a lot of structure to it. A lot of things do just happen kind of chaotically for, you know, random reasons and all of that stuff. But it is it's about kind of taking control of the world and rewriting the narrative so that you're on the side of good. It's just like that they are doing something bad. And that's the reason your life is not going the way you want it to. And you are good because you are standing against it. It is like, it's the most appealing fantasy that we all go to over and over and over. And a lot of dangerous beliefs can go that. I mean, and the real answer is like, it's UFO shit. UFO shit is like where I am now. But it's like, I don't think it's like necessarily like, you know, little gray men and all that, but there is some kind of manifestation that we hit over and over and over again, like going all the way back through folklore. There are moments that humanity comes in contact with something that it's our brain, little meat brains can't process. And then they sort of try to make sense of it. And like what that actually is, what it means, I'm open to a million different opportunities, but I do think we bump into something else sometimes.
Well, I mean, I think what's fascinating to me about like modern conspiracy thought is that it feels like for the first time in history, although conspiracy thought has come about over and over and over again. And if we're being honest, most of the time it has to do with Jewish people when it does come through. It seems like for the first time in history, like conspiracy has been gamified, you know, especially with QAnon and the way that people can actually interact with a conspiracy. They create the conspiracy themselves. That's what makes QAnon so fascinating, is that it's a conspiracy that is built upon, it's a gigantic game of yes and that has just gotten completely out of hand. It's like the id building its own conspiracy, the id of the internet building its own horrifying conspiracy that in the end still kind of works out to the same conspiracy that's always been there. It's like these conspiracies are inevitable.
Yeah. No, and it is because it's always just a dark reflection of us. And this is something like weirdly, like that touches directly onto like a few of my other comic projects, especially the way that, you know, something that I've been terrified by my entire life, especially like growing up in the social media age, is just how quickly dangerous information spreads and how poorly equipped we are for its spread, because it's just like we don't process whether or not information is good or not, like before like it passes along. And it's like I did a series very early in my career called Mimetic, which is just about like an image of a sloth posted online that ends the entire world in 3 days. And that was like the biggest, nuttiest version of that idea. It's still one of my favorite ideas. But more recently I've done a series called World Tree, which is very much about like the people who grew up like we did, and during an era where the internet was all about possibilities and like the way human connection would lead to a utopia, like all of these good things that would happen. And then cut to today, where it's just like it hasn't. It definitely has not. If anything, it's kind of pulled us in the opposite direction, because it is the manifestation of all of the kind of like darkest impulses we have and focused in this like, you know, dark, corroded way. Yeah.
Have you read the interview from one of the original internet utopianists who has looked back on the legacy of the internet? It was it's one of these guys. I can't remember what his name was exactly, but he was one of the guys that back in the 90s was selling the internet hard as this utopian thing that was going to bring the whole world together. And, you know, we absolutely can handle this responsibility. And not only that, but, you know, you're not going to believe what the world's going to look like in 2015, 2020. Everyone's going to be together. And I think around 2018, he gave an interview, full mea culpa, and it was like, yeah. Hey, I was wrong. I was so wrong. I could not have seen. I should have seen what the internet could have done. I should have warned everybody, but instead I was looking at it with rose-colored glasses.
Yeah, man. There was like an information. They called it the information superhighway, but no one put up a fucking speed limit sign. And, you know, we were just like fucking rocketing towards everything, and now we live in this age of misinformation. So it's like, it's become, there was so much information that none of it's true anymore.
Yeah.
And it's bizarre. It drives me crazy. And it's like, I love the way you did this book. And I'm sure everything I read of yours in the future is going to make me feel the same way. But when I was reading this, I couldn't help but thinking of, this is my opinion, not yours, that horrible Obama end of the world movie that just came out where, like, you know, the world ends because of misinformation. I felt like this was what that was trying to do.
Yeah.
And I feel like you nail it where they fucked up in a weird way.
Well, I'm very glad that you enjoy it.
But yeah, tell us about World Tree a little bit, because World Tree is one of the books I look forward to the most every month, because it's full of such strange ideas, and it's scary. It's beautifully drawn. Like, tell us a little bit about the concept behind it and perhaps maybe your intention behind writing that story.
Absolutely. So, I mean, it comes from a few different places. Like, I listened to, I think it was an episode of Sword and Scale, about the Luca Magnotti, murders. And because he posted those murders online. And then, but the thing that caught me was the idea of, like, it started spreading around online as a kind of like gotcha video, like a gross out video that kids were watching it and recording their reactions to watching it. And like I had to stop the listening to the podcast while I was listening to it, because it was actually playing like some of the, like, and one of the voices was so young reacting to like the video that they were watching of someone being murdered. And it was just like the most, like, one of the most, like, brutally upsetting things that I've ever, like, heard with my own ears. And it's just like, so the, you know, like that planted like a seed in the back of my mind. And it started like coming together with a lot of my feelings about the internet and how, like, how much I loved it growing up, how it used to be the sort of person that is just like, you know, going back to middle school, it's like I would race to come home to like talk to my friends online. Those were my real friends, like living through forums and AOL Instant Messenger. Like that was just like my whole life. And, you know, and then cut to today where it's just like I'm pulling back more and more from social media entirely. You know, I mostly just post like, you know, selfies of me going to the gym. That's it. That's like all I'm putting out there into the world anymore, and I'm trying to refine my connections in the real world with like real human beings and all of that, because it's just like, it brings so much more to my life. And like, I wanted to play with that kind of tension and like the past and the present. And so it kind of, so the high concept of it is, you know, that a group of friends discovered that there was an evil internet that existed beneath the internet back around 1999, and that there was something from the other side trying to break through. And this was me trying to capture that feeling from when I was a kid of when you'd click through these like GeoCity websites, web portals, and you just fall down this like weird rabbit hole to like weird websites that were just like broken websites of numbers and like glitched images that wouldn't load properly. Yeah. And it's just like you would fall into this other side of the internet. So I wanted to make that literal, where it's just like they literally fell into another internet and something malevolent was trying to come through there. And then it's the story of how they sealed it off back then and they thought it was safe. And then they thought they built the good version of the internet over it. And then you see it come hurtling back through in present day, like, and you know, like terrorizing all of these people. So it's one of the brutal things that I've written.
Yeah. Like, yeah, an actual entity coming through and terrorizing and you know, possessing and killing. Lots of killing, like much killing.
Yeah. I'm ready.
It's very, very, very bloody. It really is. And I love the idea behind it, you know, of like this. Yeah, it's like sort of the idea of like the internet actually reaching out and, you know, not just influencing people to do bad things, but telling people to do bad things, making people do horrible things.
Yeah.
Rise from your grave.
One of the things I've noticed about some of your books recently is that you've been doing a lot of like apocalyptic stuff, like with, you know, with World Tree, with Nice House on the Lake. Like, is your brain starting to sort of move towards the apocalypse lately?
I mean, it feels more like the world's moving towards the apocalypse, like slightly. And it's just the, you know, I think it's kind of reflecting that feeling. And especially like, I realized very early on, I didn't really want to write like post-apocalyptic stories. I wanted to write apocalyptic stories. I wanted to write the story about the collapse. And because it just, it feels like, you know, even though it's a less literal collapse, like we're living in an era of collapse, of systems kind of falling apart around us. They were built to work. They worked for like 3 or 4 decades, and then they worked half as well for 3 or 4 decades. And now we're in the 3 or 4 decades after that, and it's not working anymore. And at some point, we'll have to build whole new systems. But it's just like right now, we're living in this like really dangerous, weird moment. And I find it deeply fascinating and horrifying. And I think it leads to the, you know, there are the moments that lead to the worst of us. And I think as a horror writer, it's like I like leaning into the worst of us. But then I also try to like lean into what I sort of, you know, I try to bring a humanist perspective where it's just like I want to express what I think is, you know, like what I think is good in humanity as well. You know, and it's our little weird, messy bits. Like it's not our altruism or anything like that. It's like, it's kind of the ways in which we're like goofy and we fuck up. Like that's actually what make us like special.
The human moments, just little interactions between us. Like, you know, what's going to happen when everything's collapsing? Like, how are you going to make small talk with your neighbor while the world is collapsing around you?
Yeah, man. It's so, to me, so much more ballsy to write about the apocalypse as it's happening, because a lot of the post-apocalyptic stuff that you see, it's like, they don't even bother to explain it. Cause it's like, how do you explain the end of the world? You know, it's like, you know, like The Road is unbelievable, but it's all about the post. They don't even bother telling you how it happened. And so to tell us how it's going to happen, that's a ballsy move, man.
Well, you know, I mean, this is also the downside of me working on all of these very long form stories, is just like we're in the middle of a lot of them. So it's just like, we'll see if I pull it off at the end.
When do you think the world's going to end?
Yeah, I mean, hopefully after I finish telling all of these stories.
Cool.
I want to get to the end first, like that. I want to, like, then it's just like I'll make the call and just be like, all right, we can do it now.
Isn't it like every society think the world's ending around them? Isn't that how it is?
Well, I mean, that's the argument could be made that many societies have ended over and over and over again. Like the apocalypse isn't necessary. Like the apocalypse can be a very personal thing to a society. Yeah. It doesn't have to be the end of the world. It just has to be the end of that world.
Wow. Yeah.
Okay. All right. I'm going to fucking shit my pants.
Yeah. Something's going to come later. Yeah. Always something going to come later. So as a horror writer, like, you know, like what was the first horror comic book? Like not necessarily the first horror thing, not the first horror movie or the first horror story. What was the first horror comic book that didn't necessarily scare you, but the first one that kind of made you say, wow, like that was a fucking great horror story?
So it's kind of a weird one, but it was Johnny the Homicidal Maniac by Yoko Vasquez. And it's not necessarily about like it is the best constructed horror story, because it's so like messy and over the top in so many different directions. But
it's a very hot topic.
It hits a nerve, and it's just like, and it's like, you know, and especially like, you know, I was perfectly poised to receive Invader Zim when it came to me. But because I was like, I would bring copies of both, Johnny the homicidal maniac and Squee to like summer camp with me, and they would like be falling apart, and then I would get in trouble when other people like realized what I was reading.
Yeah.
Like beyond that, it was in late middle school that I started finding Vertigo comics. Like, and that was a real turning point for me. And I think those early volumes of The Sandman like changed the entire essence of like who I am as a person. And particularly the second volume of Doll's House, which is what I've been doing a Sandman series, and it's just like I built the entire premise of the series out of that arc, and focusing on the Corinthian, and particularly I think it's Sandman number 14 is the Collectors, which is one of my favorite single issues of a comic ever, is just about like a serial killer convention. Like in a rundown motel, and it's so brutal and horrifying. Like all of these little cutaways, and it's just like when I am trying to get under a reader's skin, I will like sit down and I'll reread that issue just to remember how it's done. Like, because I still think that is how it's done.
It's incredible. I mean, the art and everything is just, and it's so. It seems like such a ludicrous thing, but what's great about that issue is that there's an entire other story happening leading up to the serial killer convention, and these characters that you've been following throughout this volume, they just happen upon this. Like, they just happen upon this, and, you know, of course, there's also, you know, they may have been pushed towards it as well.
Yeah.
But it's introduced so naturally into the story of, like, these people, like, just showing up at a convention for serial killers, and they're all showing up and, like, hi, you know, like, my name is the Family Man.
I'm here.
Like, it's like, oh, the Family Man. Great. We've been waiting for you. You know, you're the keynote speaker. How wonderful. And they have panels, you know, where they talk about, like, you know, I love the one panel, the female serial killer. Like, we're not just killer nurses. You know, that whole story was very influential for me as well, because it's also a very funny issue as well. Like, it's very, like, it treats it with like this kind of like levity that informed, you know, I guess, my own personal view of serial killers.
I imagine a serial killer convention would be held at a La Quinta.
But, no, I think they'd go straight for the sponsorship there. Like,
who does the catering?
But recently you've got to dabble in the Sandman universe quite a bit recently with Nightmare Country, and you kind of got to actually retell that story a little bit and to dip your fingers. Like, how was it to, like, I don't know, put your mark on the Sandman universe?
I mean, terrifying. Absolutely terrifying. Like, the only comparable moments in my like comic book writing life was the first time that I wrote like a line of dialogue for Batman. Mm-hmm. When I was just starting out, the first scripts that I was working on was for a Batman annual that was being co-written by that I was co-writing with Scott Snyder, but I had been brought on to do the, like, I wrote the first draft and all that stuff. But I remember I reached out to Scott to be like, okay, like, I'm going to write all the Mr. Freeze bits, and then you're going to come in and write Batman, because I'm not allowed to write Batman yet. Like, I have not earned the right to write Batman. And Scott had to, like, very, like, get me on the phone and just be like, James, you have been brought on to, like, make so that I do not have to write this. You do have to write the dialogue for Batman. And that was, like, wildly intimidating. And then it was writing the Turtles, like, the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, getting those voices right and all that. But then, like, there's nothing more formative to me than the Sandman. So it's just like, honestly, and I cheated a little, where it's just like, in the first arc that we did, there are only a handful of the classic characters that appear. So it's a lot of new characters, which is that I'm very comfortable writing my own characters but once I had to actually write like words coming out of Dream's mouth, that was like, okay, yeah, no, I have to step up. It was a lot of fun. I'm really, really proud of what we've been doing there, and there's still more to come with that story.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I love the characters you introduced were great, but I could only imagine, like, the Corinthian is a character I've always wanted to play around with. Like, Corinthian's great. He's a living nightmare who has teeth for eyes.
Fuck yeah.
Yeah, that's cool. Yeah, just like, you boil it down to that, living nightmare, teeth for eyes. That's
let's
it.
Go. Yeah. Yeah.
who eats eyes with his eyes?
Whoa! Yeah. It's so impressive.
And legitimately one of the best horror images ever to exist in comics. Like, just the best. Like, yeah.
Do his eyes have little tongues? Great question.
Usually not. You, like, sometimes like you see a little tongue in there, but it's black voids.
I kind of had to rack my brain a little bit. Like, have I ever seen the Corinthians' eye tongues?
Oh my God. Yeah. Imagine being his dentist. Just, he was like, oh, open your mouth. He's like, takes off his sunglasses and shit.
Oh yeah. No. And I mean, like, we actually like leaned into that a little bit. There's this figure that's been showing up. That's like, it's a nightmare, but it didn't come from dreams. That's been shown from the dreaming that shows up through that whole series that we've been calling the Smiling Man, that also has like mouths for eyes, but you don't see the teeth there. You just see the like gross tongues sticking out of the eyes. And it's like, it's real gross. I like some gross shit. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, do you have a line for gross?
You know, I think I used to have much more of one. Like, there are things that will get under my skin if it's done really, really well. And it's just like, and at a certain point, I think like gore stops, like, you know, at a certain point, I don't enjoy the gore anymore, but I've seen like lots of real messed up stuff. I don't gravitate towards the more extreme gore end of things, but it's like, I've watched all the new French Extremity films. I really enjoy Martyrs. Like, but yeah, that's, you know, but in terms of like body horror and stuff, I love stuff that like makes me cringe and like curl up.
Yeah. I'm also a big fan of that.
Yeah. I like how in your book that I was reading, you let the imagination like really take it. Everything's cloudy. You're not sure what's going on. You see it and then you're like, oh, is that what's happening? And then my own mind fucking runs with it. And I think that's so cool.
Yeah.
And like, so much of that is getting to work with like really incredible artists, which is something that, you know, like I love, you know, like I love the fact that I'm working on so many different comic projects because I get to work with some of my all time favorite comic book artists, my favorite people working in the industry today. And like, you know, Department of Truth, I work on with Martin Simmons, who I think is, you know, he's up, like you can see the Sienkiewicz and the McKean influences in him, but he does this like collage work. That like it's actual mixed media, and the original artwork pages are just absolutely stunning. I have a few of them like hanging around my office right now, and it is just just devastatingly good. And you know, the other projects that I've been talking about, Fernando Blanco just absolutely nails like just every lip. Like we do these like 12 panel grids in World Tree, and he just nails the emotionality in that. He doesn't lose any of the information. He's just like so fucking good at it. And then Alessandro Estherin was the artist on Nightmare Country, and like he also was just like absolutely nailed it. I don't know. I'm a comic book art nerd, and like the whole like secret of my career is just like I have found excuses that my inbox gets to fill up with beautiful comic book art every single day.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Well, speaking of Martin Simmons, like the new book that you guys have been working on is a retelling of Dracula, which it's like it's Universal Monsters Dracula. Like it's very much like when you were approaching that book, like were you wanting to take like is it like a new take on Dracula or just like a different angle on like the existing Dracula story?
I want to suck your milk.
Yeah, that's the angle. That's the angle we decided to take. He's a milk sucker. You know, we've got a lot of whiteout on all of the pages. No, I mean, the real thing. It's been a few years since I've been writing like superhero comics. And when I was like in my heyday of superhero comics, like I was a big continuity nerd. I loved like how a story, like what is the official story? How can you bring a story from the past into the present? So it's been a while since I've been able to stretch those muscles. So I set a bunch of rules for myself when I started working on Universal Monsters Dracula, because it is the universal version of Dracula. like, which means that it is, you know, it's not like, it's not Mina Harker, it's Mina Seward. Like, and, you know, Dr. Seward isn't one of Lucy's suitors, it's Mina's father. It means Renfield has a much larger role in the whole story. It means they don't go back to Transylvania at the end. And John Harker never went to Transylvania. Like, that, all of those things all come from the original movie. So the, like, I leaned into that iteration of the story and made and tried to make sure that nothing that happened in the comic contradicts the scene in the movie. So it all happens around the corners of it. But the challenge was then to, how do you tell a very human story in and around the corners of that? And that was like, it was a tremendous challenge, but it was like, you know, and then the other primary goal of the entire project is, how do I like just leave room for Martin to draw the coolest images of Dracula ever? And that was my initial focus. And then he drew the first scene with Renfield. And I didn't even describe how, like, I wanted Renfield depicted, but he depicted him almost like a ghost. Like, his face is almost featureless. He's like right out of like German expressionism. It's just like, it's like a dark lined eyes and a mouth like in the darkness. And it's just like, but just like this blinding white, like against the black. And it is just, it is one of the, I think one of the best horror images in comics of the last few years. And it's like, and I take no credit for it. I had no, but the second that I saw him draw that, then it was like, all right, we're bumping up Renfield's role in this entire series, because I want him to draw that as many times as possible.
Yeah, because you can expand quite a bit. Because, I mean, how long is the original Dracula? What is it, like, you know, 75 minutes or something like that?
Yeah, maybe even, I think it's just about 70 minutes. Like, yeah. it is a very short film.
Yeah, so I guess watching it, you were able to, like, expand quite a bit on, you know, what happened off camera.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, and then on top of that, there are a lot of things that you couldn't do in a movie in that moment. Like, you can't really lean into the blood. Obviously, yeah. Like, you know, you can talk about, like, hey, we're watching, you know, Dracula was just in the room and now there's a wolf running across the field. Like, but you mm-hmm. can't show a man transform into a wolf. Like, and it's in little elements like that. And then the other decision we made is, through the entire miniseries, Dracula, like, there's only one line of dialogue that Dracula speaks in the entire book, because I wanted to make him a full monster, a presence, yeah. Like, not someone who's, you know, I didn't want to lean into like the charm of Dracula, but characters talk about interacting with him. So it's just like those scenes still happen, but it's not those moments. It is the more monstrous power of him. And then the big thing that I was leaning into, like, strongly, that Martin and I both synced in on, is that the movie does this amazing thing where it just cuts into like the eyes of Bela Lugosi over and over and over. And they're all like lit up and like, and so I just wanted to, like, that's like the hypnotic power of Dracula. And it's just like, you see the like color of life kind of coming out of him, and the rest of the world around him is like really black and white. But then like this, like, phantasmagoria of color and gore, like coming out of Dracula. And that was like the center of the idea.
It's incredible. Do you like the old, are you into the old Universal horrors, Eddie?
You know, I rewatched, one of the really old ones. I think it was Dracula, actually, like a couple of years ago. And the thing that I realized is, a lot of those old movies, they don't have scores. Like, there's no, yeah. it's just because you forget how much work a score does. And so like they were, you know, so they're not as scary as like a current movie is, because it's all imagery and no score. But yeah, no, I mean, they're all wonderful. And right now I know for a fact that Universal is doubling down on all their monsters.
Yeah.
And oh,
yeah.
It's a perfect time for you to be involved, man. That's congrats. Oh, yeah. Especially with the land, they're opening a full theme park land.
That's
it's
crazy.
Like the first like horror land in a theme park is about to open.
That's great.
And I think that's so cool. And you're a part of it now, apparently.
I'm like, it's exciting. It's very exciting. And I think there's a lot of really cool things coming out of that space. And honestly, like, working with Alex Antone and the team at Skybound to just sort of like what they have planned for all of the Universal Monster books. And I can neither confirm nor deny which other monster I may be working on. You know, it's fun. It's like, I'm not working on a lot of licensed projects anymore. Pretty much everything I'm doing is now fully in the creator-owned space. But getting to tap into like one of the big icons, there's just power in it. And, like, it's hard to say no to a project like that. So I didn't.
Hell yeah. Well, yeah. You know, speaking of like, you know, icons, you know, powerful characters and all that, like when you wrote Batman, you spent a ton of time with the Joker, like Joker War, fucking incredible. Loved it. Like, do you see Joker as a horror character?
Absolutely. And, but I think that I'm open to other takes. I do not think that there is a like pure singular version of the Joker. Like, because the Joker is just the perfect opposite of Batman. So whatever Batman is, you make the perfect opposite of him, and that's whatever the Joker is. So in a more like, you know, the Joker in Batman 66 is still a perfect like inversion of the Adam West Batman. Actually, I'd say Riddler is probably more in Batman 66, but the Joker is, he's a fascinating character. And it's just like, I know people get burned out on him. There are so many Joker stories and, but there's a reason you go back to it. And it's just a, you know, there's something that's just cool about like, you know, it's sometimes superheroes are so baked in to pop culture that we kind of like don't look at it at face value that often. But it's just like, you know, you're in a world where it's just like this classic pulp hero in Batman, like this man dressed up in a cape with like a pointy cowl. And he's fighting like a murderous clown. And it's just like it comes out of that, like the pulp, like of the pulp stories of that era. And it's just like it is so like it is like a primal part of our culture. And that dichotomy is interesting. And it's like, I'm always going to find it interesting. I'm always I'm always going to be a Batman nerd, but I also like, I like the different elements of him. And I've written him a few different ways. And it's just like, he does have to be a little funny when he's not funny at all, it doesn't work.
No.
But there are other characters that I'm a bit firmer on. Like, you know, I think that there's a right way to do the Riddler and the wrong way to do the Riddler. But it's just like with the Joker, you can do the Joker so many different ways.
Yeah. To me, the Joker's like a mob boss who doesn't care about money, just chaos, you know? Like,
So is there like, was there, I guess if you didn't have the restrictions of being, you know, writing for DC, like how far would you go with the Joker? Like, was that sort of like a line that like DC wouldn't let you cross?
I mean, I started during the New 52. When I started writing the Joker, he literally had his face had been taken off and was like pinned to his face. Like that is the version of the Joker I started writing. Yeah. And then on top of that, when I did my Joker series with Guillaume March, it was I pit the Joker up against, it's basically if the core concept was, what if the, you know, the family from Texas Chainsaw Massacre at the end of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, when he's throwing the like chainsaw around it, he like accidentally throws it into the ground. And then you hit the beginning of the Beverly Hillbillies where oil spouts. And so it's just the Texas Chainsaw Massacre family becoming like billionaires. And you see this entire, like it's a serial killing family of like billionaires that then they are convinced that they decide that they're going to hunt and kill the Joker because they're cannibals and they want to eat the head guy of the family wants to bring Joker to Texas to kill him and cook him and eat him. So I went pretty far, but it's also, that's funny. Like it does still have to be a little ridiculous. It has to be fun. Like it can't, like if it's just, like, I don't know. There have been really good stories that have been done where he's just like brutally horrifying. But at a certain point, it's just like, then why is that the Joker? Like, what's the clown angle? Like, what's the fun? Where's the joke?
Yeah, exactly. There's always got to be a joke with the Joker.
That's what's so beautiful about comic books over movies. It's like, you don't have to limit your imagination at all. You can do whatever the hell you want. And then you're like, yeah, draw it. It sounds great. You don't have to worry about like, you know, blowing up a boat, you know? He's just like, yeah, just blow up the boat.
You have to worry about the artist sometimes. I remember one time, like it was one of the first times I was writing the Joker. I was doing the backup stories of a Joker story in Batman. And I was working with the artist Jock. And I made him draw, like, the Joker was like building this whole beautiful scene inside of Arkham Asylum to like torment Batman with. And he was like, you know, doing it in his usual Joker way. So he's making the guards of Arkham literally carry a horse in down the hallway because he didn't want the horse to walk on the ground because then it would be ruined. Like, and so you saw it was like four men trying to carry an upside down horse down a hallway. And Jock like almost killed me. Having to draw a horse is like one of the worst things to make an artist do. Trying to draw an upside down horse like is a nightmare.
Yeah. Yeah, we ran across the same thing on like an issue of Soul Plumber where we asked our artist to show like the Vatican like exploding or like being dismantled, and he was like, I don't have time for that. He's like, these are tight deadlines, man. You're working for DC. Yeah. Like they're not going to. Yeah.
I'm going to pull my weight and say rewrite.
Yeah.
For the Joker, I know you're not doing the DC stuff right now, but man, one thing about the Joker is like my problem with it is like as a comedian, I want to see his act.
Yeah.
Like I want to see, I want to see what he's got. Like, yeah. I want to know his material. I want to see his jokes.
I'll lend you the Killing Joke.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's the Joker origin story. Yeah. He did start as a failed stand-up comedian. He was bad.
Yeah.
He was real bad.
Like the movie.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, yeah. Okay. Yeah. But in a completely different way. Like it's one of the best comic book stories ever written.
It's got to have a couple good ones.
that's the tragedy of it is that he can make his wife laugh, but can't make anyone else laugh.
Oh.
And then she dies.
Poor bastard.
By accident.
One bad day.
One bad day. Yep.
Live from your grave.
So last time you were on the show, we talked about Blue Book, Betty and Barney Hill. This month, you've got a new Blue Book coming out, 1947. Tell us about 1947.
So, you know, it brings me back together with Michael Avon Oeming, who is just absolutely incredible. If you haven't read Powers by him and Brian Michael Bendis, go read Powers. It is like one of the best blends of like superhero and noir that's ever been done.
Yeah. It's a couple of cops in a town of superheroes.
Cool.
Yeah, yeah. It's great. You know, like Blue Book came together because, you know, Mike and I are like big UFO nerds and he was a big fan of Department of Truth, reached out to me and was just like, hey, like, you know, he was excited about how I was talking about UFOs in there. And then the conversation kind of picked up from there. And then ultimately we decided that, you know, something that I'd been missing since like I was a kid was just there used to be like lots of comics that were telling like the strange but true stories. It was the, you know, stories of the paranormal story. And it was just like based on the actual like accounts of the paranormal. So right now I'm kind of calling that like, you know, it's like the cousin of true crime. And I'm calling that like true weird. And I like being, and I'm like trying to build over, you know, through the partnership between Tiny Onion and Dark Horse right now. Like we're trying to put out more of these true weird stories. And the ones that I'm directly involved in are these Blue Book stories, which are stories that are based on the real accounts of UFO encounters. And it's like it's not like overly fictionalizing them. It's not trying to like take one little kernel and build like a totally different narrative. I want to lean into like the moments as the like, you know, as they are purported to have happened by the witnesses. And, you know, so that's the kind of the core principles of the thing. But the subject matter for 1947 came together, like when I was just laying together research for the Department of Truth. And no one had like ever said out loud to me before, but just laying the dates down next to each other, I realized that the Kenneth Arnold, you know, UFO sightings that led to the coining of the term flying saucer happened about 3 weeks before the crash at Roswell, New Mexico.
Oh, so yeah.
The entire basis of like the American culture's obsession of UFOs happened in one summer in 1947. And it's just like everything comes from that summer. And then beyond that, it's just like the way that the media interacts with UFO stories, like all of those, like the fact that like local newspapers suddenly realize that it's like, oh yeah, we can start running some of these stories and people are interested in hearing them. Like it all comes from right then. And then the other thing that happened is like, this is also the summer that, you know, the US government started building like programs and be like, there's a little too many of these stories going around and we should look into it. And it's so we're able to, over the course of five issues, kind of piece together like each of the angles of that summer. Like we talk about the Kenneth Arnold, everything with Kenneth Arnold, the entire flap of UFO encounters that was happening over those few weeks. And there's a lot of like really iconic ones that happened really close together.
I appreciate you using the word flap, by the way. When you know someone knows what they're talking about when they use the word flap correctly.
Oh yeah. No, and I mean like Oming would be like he'd be like bringing in UAP a little like interchanging. I like UFO. Yeah.
As do I.
Yeah, but you know the term of like the idea of flying saucers, the idea of the public image, and then like what I found really really fascinating was just the way that you see the first people who get little they have one what seems like a real encounter with the strange. And then they start becoming a little bit famous for it. And then they just lean in and suddenly they see a lot more UFOs and all that. And it's just like, it's the seeing the way that fame spreads and like a story spreads around the country is also deeply fascinating to me. Yeah. So it's just like, it's a story that like we lean into what people purport to have seen and purport to have encountered. But we also take a critical lens where it's just like, you can see the people who may have been the moments that they were a little more glory hounding than necessarily encountering something like, you know, otherworldly. Yeah.
And that was really before the days when we all learned that UFOs ruin lives. Being a witness to a UFO or being an abductee, like these people do not. Travis Walton doesn't live a happy life. Whitley Strieber does not live a happy life. These people are damaged by this stuff. And people that, you know, come out and talk about their alien experiences, usually their entire lives fall apart pretty quickly. Why do you think UFOs ruin lives so thoroughly?
I mean, like, I think that
you play with this in Department of Truth as well. We talked about it last time. One of my favorite stories and the entire, but the Bigfoot storyline. Oh, yeah.
No, I'm going to start weeping.
Honestly, that Bigfoot story is one of my favorite things I've ever written. And I think it speaks to exactly this. There is just when you bump into something like fantastic, like how can it not change your life? Like, how can it not, like, you know, that just defies everything that has come before and all of that. Like, suddenly it's just like you want to make sense of the world. You want to make sense of what you saw. And it's just like it. And then especially if there's a moment where suddenly you get a lot of attention for it. And then it's just like it builds up the importance of all of it. And it's just like it's hard to shake. And I think that there's something very human in that, that I think is, you know, it's like sad and beautiful. And I think it's something that is, you know, it exists outside of the realm of like paranormal encounters. It's something that's just like, you see people who it's just like one moment in their life that did not fit among everything else. It just becomes, you know, this like one of the driving forces of the rest of your life.
Yeah, man, that's what makes Close Encounters like such an interesting alien movie. You know, because it's not scary. It's not a scary movie. It's just like, no, it breaks your brain. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then there is no other choice but to join them.
Yeah.
it's crazy.
No, there was a story that wrote for Last Comic Book on the Left that the second part's going to be coming out in the next issue. It's a story I've been wanting to tell for years now, and I finally got a chance to do it. The story of Betty Andreessen, who had this insane encounter with a group of aliens in which her alien experience manifested itself through Christian iconography. She was a hardcore Christian. And yet with her alien experience, the things that she saw during her abduction all harken back to these archaic Christian symbols that she would have had no clue were attached to the early days of Christianity. A lot of like phoenixes and worms and ashes and all sorts of stuff. And yet that's what she saw. She was a housewife in the 60s with five kids. She didn't have fucking Google. Like, she didn't know any of this stuff. But after her experience, like, she could not go back to her normal life. She ended up divorcing her husband, but she's one of the very few people whose life was actually made better. She got out of an unhappy marriage, found a guy who had an almost identical abduction experience. They got married and lived the rest of their lives together doing UFO conferences.
There we go.
Yeah.
That's actually sweet.
That is, you know, it's the, those are the moments of beauty and the connecting in these like little, you know,
I'd be so annoyed if I got abducted. Just be like, I do not have time for this. I have deadlines. I got jokes to write. Like, what time are we getting back?
Yeah. And they'd be like, time's not real. What do you mean?
Yeah. All right, you call Marcus and tell him I can't fucking make it. Like,
please. So when is the first issue coming out?
So I think it is out, I think it's out the second to the last. I should have this date like right in front of me. It's because I know originally it was coming out on Valentine's Day, and now I think it's 1 week after Valentine's Day. So I think by the time this comes out, I think it'll be out in stores. So you should just go to your local comic shop, say that you want to read about the UFOs, and they'll point you to, in the direction of Blue Book.
Great. And so you said earlier this is a joint venture between Dark Horse and Tiny Onion, your company, which has become like you it's now your own business.
Yeah, no. So, you know, it's really exciting. We're kind of entering a whole new era that's built off of the last few years of my success in creator-owned comics. And basically we're building up a production company around Tiny Onion, around my books. And, you know, in the publishing space, what we're going to be doing is similar to what we've been, what I've been doing for the last few years, where, you know, I have some books over at Dark Horse. I have some books over at Image. I have some books over at Distillery, the new publisher. Like this. So we're kind of like, we've got our fingers in all these different places, but we're an independent production company. We build the books and then we take them to the publisher that we think, you know, will do the best job with them. And we have a great partnership right now with Dark Horse Comics, doing this like True Weird line. And then the series Oddly Pedestrian Life of Christopher Chaos. You know, we're having a lot of fun. And, you know, these are books that I'm really, really excited about people reading. But beyond that, I'm really excited for everyone to see what we've got cooking with Tiny Onion. Like this is, I think when the announcement dropped in like mid-February, and now people are starting to like ask the question of like, what are you up to? What are you up to, James? you know, soon people are going to find out what I'm up to, and I'm very excited to tell them. And
that's great.
You know, and the real thing is like, we're starting in publishing, but you know, we're going to make inroads in a lot of the other media spaces, and it's nice being able to kind of drive that myself, rather than having to work through, you know, a bunch of middlemen to get there. We want to we just want to make stuff. We want to make really cool things.
Fuck yeah, man. It's the only way to do it. You don't fuck it. You just do it yourself. Always. Absolutely. That's the way we've been doing it here at the fucking network for years. It's like, just take the reins and do it yourself. That's always the best way to do it.
It's so impressive, everything you do. I know. And I know you probably can't talk about this, but it seems like your graphic novels, your comic books, they're made to be films. Like, are any of these like, you don't have to say which or whatever, but are you working on any of that stuff?
I mean, so there are two that I can talk about, you know, and I can't talk much about them, but I mean, like, so my series from Boom Studios, Something is Killing the Children, is in development, at Netflix right now, as a TV show. We have the creative team behind like 1899 and Dark, Baron Bodar and Yante Fries.
Dark.
And they're doing an amazing job, you know, and it's like, it's Hollywood. I won't believe it's happening until I see, like, you know, until I'm on set, like, and I see a camera filming, you know, Erica Slaughter with the mask on. Like,
even then, you don't believe it, by the way.
Yeah. don't believe it until you're at home on your couch. And the fucking thing comes up on Netflix. Because I've heard there's been a couple of horror stories from.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, people lately that have been pretty fucking awful.
But if you don't mind, could you, like, what is that process of selling your comic book and getting it moved into a film? Like, could you go into that a little bit?
I mean, it's a long, weird road. And so the other project like that, like, I've seen more of the steps of the process around Department of Truth, like, which, so right now, Department of Truth was picked up by a production company called Sister. We've gone through a few drafts of the pilot. Like, we have a really, really good draft right now. We're going around to directors. Once we have that package together, we'll go around to find the network that to pick it up and do that. But it's just like, this is something that, you know, it's a multi-year process.
Yeah.
We've gone through multiple iterations. We've talked through, a lot of different ways to handle it. It's a lot of Zoom meetings. I've done a few trips out to LA to throw ideas up on the whiteboard. But it's just the benefit of that is just it's a refining process. And there, there are also I have watched closely and from afar the opposite of the positive refining process that thankfully I haven't sort of been wrapped up in as much, but it is you can see the long road. You can see the version where sometimes it's like you sell your idea and then you kind of realize that the person that you sold it to is just they're trying to sell your idea to an even bigger company. And then they're going to try to sell their idea to a bigger company. And it's just it's all about moving a pool of money around in a circle.
Yeah. It turns into the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen situation. Yeah.
And the real thing is that it's this is part of why I wanted to, have my own company and have a bit more of a hand in controlling it, because I want to find the partners that actually want to make things. Like, that's the, and where possible, I would just want to make it myself. And, and that requires a lot of relationships. It's all people, everything's people. But I mean, comics is all people too. And it's just everything is all people. That's the, that's the one of the secrets of the world, is you just have to, be good at having a conversation, is sort of how you get things done. And, thankfully I've had a lot of practice now, and hopefully I can put my money where my mouth is. And it's just and actually bring one of these projects to life in another medium. But it is it's an exciting, fun, it's a fun game. I always, when I make something as a comic, it's just the comic itself is it's the full entity of what I'm intending to create. And then it's what I always talk, when I talk to people who are adapting my work, it's just I always want to be take the beating heart of this and then build something new around the beating heart. I don't want a direct adaptation. I want you to take the best ideas of this and then make something really, really good. Because it's just I think you can, I think that the core concept can be approached from so many different angles. And, and on top of that, we've seen so many kind of a lackluster direct adaptation of a thing. And it's just I'm not interested in it.
Mm-hmm. That's very cool of you, man, to let people have fun with your work.
Yeah.
That takes a lot of courage.
Yeah.
In yourself.
Ask me again in 15 years after I see a few people do it wrong, and then I'll be no, direct adaptation. I want every line of dialogue from the comic directly on the screen.
Well, the storyboard's done. You just fire that guy. You're saving money.
There we go.
Well, James, thank you so much for joining us today, man. It's always a pleasure to talk.
Yeah, it's great to be here. I'm super, super honored to be able to talk about all of these projects with you guys. And I'm excited about everything to come. Yeah.
Hell yeah.
Hell yeah.
So, man. I hear Department of Truth coming back soon.
Yeah. No, I couldn't skip an election year with Department of Truth. This is the exact moment the country is going to be messed up in the exact way that I'm talking about in this book. But Martin and I have finished the interior art on Dracula. And Martin has dived directly into the next issue of Department of Truth. We are going back strong. The next three issues, I've called that mini arc Dallas 1963.
Fuck yeah,
we're going right back to the core of it. We're leaning right into Lee Harvey Oswald, and the birth of like what American conspiracy really is all about. It all starts in that, in, you know, 11/22/63.
Man, the end of that first issue of Department of Truth, man, when you fucking make that reveal, I was like, when you thought of that, did you just like start masturbating immediately?
No comment.
No, that was at that moment with it's like, hi, I'm Lee Harvey. Like, that was one of the very few moments I was reading a comic book and I out loud went, oh, fuck. Fuck, yeah, yeah, all right. I'm fucking in. Oh, all right, but yeah, Department of Truth, the trades are out in the stores. If you're a Last Podcast on the Left fan, it's, you know, I've been saying it for years now. If you're a fan of the show, you're going to be a fan of Department of Truth. It's going to blow your fucking mind. And of course, you know, Blue Book, you can read the Betty and Barney Hill series. I think, is that out in a, is there a trade out yet? There's a trade out for Betty and Barney Hill. That series is great as well. And go pick up Blue Book 1947 and go to your local comic book store and buy these fucking books. Find your local comic book store and go buy all of this shit. Every time you buy a comic book, buy it from a comic book store. And if they don't have it, ask them to order it. And if they give you shit, go to a different comic book store.
Yeah, man. They're very friendly, the one by me. They order, whenever I went in there looking for Operation Sunshine, they didn't have it. They went and called a bunch of other comic book stores, went and got it for me. I was so impressed.
Yeah, which store is that?
Collector's Paradise.
Yeah, Collector's Paradise is great. My local store, my store is Earth 2. We got, there's some great stores out here in Los Angeles. Oh,
yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
All right.
It was very nice to meet you, buddy.
Nice to meet you too, man.
Oh, yeah.
All right. Yeah. Goodbye, everybody.
Bye.
This show is made possible by listeners like you. Thanks to our ad sponsors, you can support our shows by supporting them. For more shows like the one you just listened to, go to lastpodcastnetwork.com.